I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. If you can't get people to the art, then take the art to the people. That's what the Indianapolis Airport Authority decided to do when they opened the new Indianapolis International Airport in 2008. A partnership between the IAA and the Arts Council of Indianapolis offers Indiana artists the opportunity to be paid to show their work for a limited amount of time in special art display cases in the terminal.
My name is Katie Norman. I'm the Community Events Specialist for the Indianapolis Airport Authority. We've been showing work since 2013 in this kind of rotating temporary style in these art cases. And through it, we've been able to feature almost 70 different local artists. And when I say local, I mean either from Indiana or currently living there.
Julia Moore, Director of Public Art, Arts Council of Indianapolis. We select artists in a number of ways. Artists can send a proposal. They can put themselves forward or somebody else or, you know, whatever they want to do. And then we can take a look at that. And sometimes there'll be a lot of back and forth to say, well, I like this or you know, how about talking a little bit more about that? And then we'll put together something.
My name is Barbara Stahl, and I am a professional artist. I own Stahl Studios, and we do large corporate kind of signage, the Pacer schedule wall, the gallery ads inside of that, public art murals, and then my fine art is what I do for me. I have been in Indianapolis for a long time and part of the art scene, so I kind of just knew about these cases when they came, but I didn't, because I'm a fine artist, and the stuff that I had seen in them seemed to be a little bit different. And I didn't know if I could relate. And then I saw some art in the cases that was fine art. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I can do that. So I made a proposal, and they accepted it. Dancing Streams is whimsically inspired by a theory in physics that's been around for many decades and been developing called string theory. String theory postulates that everything in the universe is comprised or made of harmonies created by infinitesimally small vibrating strings. And my work in general and kind of where my heart is about being in a universal symphony just was something that I found really delightful. I wanted to bring the light and the chaos together. I wanted it to be neutral enough for a platform like the airport where you have people from all over the world, but I wanted it to be compelling enough that it would want you to walk up and see it. And the background white is actually made with a citron metallic powder mixed with white and a medium, and so it actually sort of glows. And when I put the cadmium red with it, to me it just sung.
I like art that gives people something to hold on to, and I like art that works on a number of levels. So something that has something to do with, you know, what people are wanting to see when they're in the airport. The airport is a space that's really very in between. It's neither here nor there. It's part of Indiana, but it's also in transit. And so there are a lot of people that like to do works that are about traveling, about being in that in-between space, and I'm really attracted to that kind of work.
My name is John Puffer, and I am a retired professor of art at Vincennes University. I do get newsletters from the Arts Council, and Julia Moore, I started talking to her one time about my idea for an exhibit of my photographs of Pompeii, and I've been to Pompeii about 15 times, but always leading groups of students, college students, and so I would photograph when I could. I like to say it's like herding cats when you have students trailing behind you. I thought it'd be great if sometime I could just, you know, when I retire, I could just go to Pompeii and spend a whole half a summer, which I did last year. All of these are made up of more than one photograph, which are then stitched together in Photoshop. So I spend a lot of time, probably as much more time at the computer screen as I do out taking the photographs. I want you to get the feeling that you were actually there, even though you might not know what you're looking at. A lot of people ask me, for example, what is this?
What is it?
It's a wall. It's just a wall. You can just put yourself there. You can stand in a room. If you have imagination, you can be there. You can be there with people, with Pompeians.
You are?
Vicki Clark from Indianapolis.
And what caught your eye when you were walking by?
I don't know. It looks nice, and I thought I just stopped to look.
But what kind of impression does seeing art in an airport have on you?
It's just really nice to see places you might want to go.
We try to vary the program enough that if you are flying even just once, you can see a number of pieces that give you a variety of different perspectives. But if you fly frequently and you fly, you know, several months apart, you'll see changes that together give you a picture of what this place is.
Big ones from this year has been Kip Norman's When Lindbergh Reached Paris. His piece was sort of highlighting the Paris flight and tied in really nicely with things going on in the terminal during that time.
People really like, and we did a piece by Jamie Paulus in 2014, a piece called Happiness. People thought that was amazing.
It had this big arrow and said happiness on it and sort of mimicked the wayfinding signage in the airport. So it seemed like it belonged here, which was really cool.
Jamie Paulus, I'm an artist.
How did you come up with that idea of happiness?
Well, I went to the airport many times when I was asked by Julia to do the project, and as I sat there watching people for days and hours and enjoying myself kind of watching that happen, I was noticing people were walking out of the planes and with their heads down, just walking straight out to the baggage area or just to leave the airport. And after a while, I was just like, they're all going in the same direction. They're all looking down. So it's like, where are they going? Where are they headed? What is up for them? You know, what are they looking forward to at this point? But, you know, it just seemed kind of like a little bit of sadness as they just kind of looked down. The other thing I was noticing is that it was wintertime when I was doing this, when I was trying to think of ideas. And I was in the biggest funk ever. So it just kind of occurred to me, you know, just like, they're walking towards happiness. Let's have them do that. It's like something that I would like to do for myself, you know, tell myself I need to go that way. So make it for other people. And plus it's like that space was, it just looked like it could be a big light box. I put light inside of it, and then I had printed vinyl of it on the outside, adhesive vinyl put on it, and lots of measurements and trying to figure out how that would work best as a light box, since I've never done anything like that before.
Were you happy with it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I was very happy with it. And it was a hard project in the sense that when I came up with the idea, I had no idea how much it would actually cost to do that. And when I went to a couple of the local places in town, they ended up giving me like the lighting. ESL just gave me all the lighting that would go inside of it, so I wouldn't have been able to do it without those guys. I don't know how it would have happened. So
where is it now?
When I had to remove it, it basically was just like taking off a giant sticker, just watered it up, and so then I carried it in the passenger seat of my car for probably about a couple months, and I threw it in the trunk, and then I finally threw it away.
You are an artist yourself. Why is it important to bring art essentially to the people?
As an artist, I understand how important it is for the airport to be a platform for the arts community. This is the first place that a lot of travelers come through on their way to Indianapolis. And as an airport, it's really cool to be able to feature local artists here, to be able to show what Indy has to offer in the art scene. And these are all people who are important to the culture here. So being able to display that and also supporting the local arts economy is a really great role to play, just as a public entity and wanting to really support those artists.
Indianapolis International also has numerous permanent art installations by Indiana artists in the parking garage and the terminal, and most of the rotating art cases are located before the TSA security checkpoint, so you don't have to be a ticketed traveler to experience the art. Each week we bring you Making It, an audio postcard from an Indiana DIY or do-it-yourself artist. This week, WFYI's Melissa Davis takes us to the studio of artist Chris Johnson, where he talks about filming his first documentary about a game similar to soccer but played on a hard court.
So, the documentary, the working title is Copa de Kid Chocolate. It's about us trying to put on a futsal tournament in Havana, Cuba. And all the struggles and hurdles that we come across attempting to get this goal done. Futsal is getting big in Cuba, just like it's getting big in Indiana. We wanted to go down there so that we could learn more about how futsal is growing in the communities there and how it's becoming a community development tool. And we wanted to see if we could implement that in Indianapolis. And also, we wanted to bring our knowledge of how we put together courts and how we put together tournaments down there to see if we can kind of like build this project together with each other. So this clip right here, this is from our Cuba trip where I was working on a documentary about futsal. This clip comes in the middle of the trailer, and I think thematically it'll come in the middle of the movie as well. It's when Ethan, a young intern that is also a coordinator, is talking about the worst case scenario. So I'll play that because I need to listen to it to chop it up to fit it into the trailer anyway. So,
worst case scenario, all in all,
tournament would likely have canceled at least for this week. During our time being here, that's not something we're looking for.
I like that. I've already trimmed it a little bit. I just need to boost the audio. You can hear the rain in the background. We're stuck inside of a tiny little shack waiting for it to stop raining so we can continue filming the, or continue having a tournament. But it's tough because it rained every single day we were there.
Could you explain futsal?
Futsal is a lot like soccer, but it's on a smaller court. More like soccer being played on a basketball court. It's faster. It's more about the footwork. You get your techniques down in this game. You can also play it in a lot of urban settings because there's less space. So, with a big wide soccer field, you'll find that more in like the rural areas and in cities that have the space for that. But most cities are small and compact and close together. So a futsal court can essentially fit in anywhere and be a variety of different sizes.
And how does Indianapolis factor into your art?
I think with Indianapolis being like the crossroads of America, people here tend to pick up a lot of different things from different places and kind of hodgepodge it together. And for me, I don't really specifically have one sound or one vision. I kind of pull things in from all over. So I think that making a documentary in a certain location kind of gives you the vibe of that location. Making music in a certain location gives you that vibe. That's why, at least in America and even all over the world, you've got different regions that sound like something different or have a different art style from it.
What was it like to film in Cuba?
Filming in Cuba was absolutely crazy. Just every time you turn on the camera, there was something to see, something was going on. It's so different from Indianapolis that I felt like every single second that I was getting felt important. It's going to be really hard to cut this down to something that makes sense instead of just lining up every single shot I had and just showing it to the world. Towards the end of the trip, I was really hoping to get some local musicians playing some music that I would be able to use in the trailer. And I know I'm definitely going to use it in the documentary, but as the trailer was going, the music didn't quite fit. I don't know. I'll play a little bit of it for you. I'm going to definitely use it in the documentary, but not in the trailer. I heard this song maybe 100 different times in 100 different ways on the island. Absolutely became in love with it. But it doesn't have the exact hype feel that I want for the trailer, so I'm planning on using probably something with a little more trap appeal. Towards the end, I'm going to be using this clip that I've been working on here.
Look at Papito Valladares, a barber whose success allowed him to improve conditions in his neighborhood.
If you can't tell whose voice that is, it's President Obama's. So as Obama is talking about Papito, I cut to inside of Papito's home slash salon slash museum where he's standing because he's an integral part to this whole entire process too. And I just think it's really interesting that Obama got to meet with him and he's like a pillar of his community and we got to be in that community and kind of see the change that he was talking about. It's really crazy, the sense of community that they have.
What was it like being in Cuba?
Everybody's really friendly in Cuba. Everybody was ultra nice. There was a lot of smiles and a lot of people trying to help out. We walked and walked and we were well away from the touristy areas and people were still smiling and friendly. It was awesome. I was really just surprised by the Cuban people.
What keeps you going with your art?
The thing that keeps me going with my art is the struggle to tell a story. I love telling stories, and I think that once you incorporate either music or video, it's a better way to tell a story. The audiovisual experience together can kind of pull more emotion than just one or the other by themselves. So the thing that keeps me going is just wanting to tell more and wanting to entertain more and educate more.
Just ahead on Curious Mix. Can you dig it?
They're not particularly great looking without the art that's being added, so we thought it would kind of bring a little life to the city.
This musician can.
What I brought was a marimba, you know, in a big, gigantic case that looks like a coffin. You know, I've always joked that if I die here, you can bury me in that thing.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Small town Indiana comes to life in the book Potato Ridge. The title is the name given to a fictionalized version of Brookville, Indiana. Curious Mix contributor Matt Pelzer grew up near Brookville and spoke with the book's author, Mark McLean.
Reading this book, it's clear that the author's strong suit is in writing characters' personal introspections.
He went there when he wanted to be there. People go down to the river to fish or be baptized or to stand in the river to pray or wash dogs. The water was always busy washing things up, washing the rocks on our shoreline, washing away the stress from the stressed, cleaning the ache from the aching. Singing and washing was always going on, changing from season to season for reason to reason.
And author Mark McLean is just as rhapsodic off the cuff when describing the Whitewater River.
There's something about the sound and the flow of water that cleanses one's spirit. There is so much in this book that takes place on the confluence there of those two rivers as they hurry south towards the Ohio River. It is a place of solace that has a different voice in any of the seasons of the year.
His love affair with Brookville started when he arrived in town decades ago with a teaching degree and not much else. And that experience made it into the book through its main character, Felix.
The idea about hitchhiking into town in the middle of the night actually did happen.
McLean, like Felix, is an English teacher, a Vietnam veteran, and lives just outside of town near the Whitewater River, though he insists he and Felix are not the same person.
There's a lot of me in Felix, only I don't think that I am as noble as Felix is, maybe, if you will.
Potato Ridge takes place in the late 60s, early 70s, with both serious and witty commentary on the issues of the time, like youth culture, feminism, and the Vietnam War. It is, at its core, a character book, and its most memorable characters are taken from real life. Take the identical twin brothers who ran a barbershop.
They did get into an argument because one was taking more than his share of produce from their communal garden, and they never spoke to each other the rest of their life, even though they lived in the same house, and even though they worked side by side for 50 years. If they had to say something to the brother, they would just ask one of their customers to tell his brother this or that. They did exist.
It was a real thing.
Yeah, you can't make something like that
up. I suppose not. There are a lot of funny characters in this book, but there are some serious moments as well.
The character that really made me almost cry was the character of Butchie.
That's because he based that character on an actual student of his who had a rough home life and died in his mid-20s. But Butchie's story is left with a more hopeful ending in the book.
He sort of echoes the beginning of the book where he goes out to the highway and he sticks his thumb out and he heads south out to where the road disappears around the bend. I hitchhiked in. He hitchhiked out.
What I loved about the book were the short chapters. Before I knew it, I'd read 30 pages and was just getting warmed up.
One of my primary concerns in writing this book was to make it readable. People can read the book probably in 2 or 3 days or so.
And indeed I did. And I'm a slow reader. Overall, Potato Ridge is a fun, nostalgic, and beautifully written look at small-town Indiana. For Curious Mix, I'm Matt Pelser.
Dig Indy is a massive underground project that, when complete, will help sewage overflow in the Indianapolis area. In the meantime, it's causing a lot of street closures and traffic delays as workers create 30 miles of underground tunnels hundreds of feet below the city. Some local artists have found a way to help ease the traffic woes of motorists. Curious Mix contributor Carter Barrett has more on this creative cover-up.
Walking through the hallway of the Harrison Center for the Arts first Friday on July 6th, people eat Indian food and sip wine and stand and look at the dozens of circular wood panels on the walls, each decorated by a different local artist. Some of them are minimalist, pink cloud-like, in an abstract collage of color, but others are intricately detailed, like a downtown skyline or a black and white fish. Of the 40 panels displayed, 20 would soon be selected to replicate their design onto a manhole cover to be displayed on the Indianapolis Cultural Trail.
It's really graphic. There's a character, there's like a portrait, like an abstract portrait of a character, very simple, simplified. And it also says, "Can you dig it?" I thought it was kind of funny and appropriate to kind of play with the message of Dig Indy. So, my name is William Denton Ray. I'm a fine artist, painter, builder.
Ray's manhole cover design was one of the finalists.
So that's why I think it's important, because art is it has a high visual impact, and if people see it, they'll become interested in it, and then they'll learn about what Citizens Energy is doing.
I'm Jeff Brown with Citizens Energy Group.
Why manhole covers?
Well, because they cover the sewer lines and utility lines, again, that are buried underground and a lot of people don't think about, and they're not particularly great looking without the art that's being added, so we thought it would kind of bring a little life to the city.
Brown says he was drawn to the covers that use the environment and water as themes. The $2 billion project's ultimate goal is to clean Indianapolis rivers for recreation and economic development. One of these artists, Christina Hollering's manhole cover, is perfectly symmetrical portrait of snakes, cranes, fish, and turtles. She was also a finalist.
Taking things that are mundane, such as manhole covers or like a signal box and stuff like that, something that may not be considered attractive, and providing something of interest, and also informing the city about its local artists and giving them a little taste, a little sample of what we have to offer.
The tunnel system is slated for completion in 2025, and the first 5 manhole covers are along Alabama Street from North Street to New York Street. For Curious Mix, I'm Carter Barrett.
Colombian musician Juan Rojas moved to Bloomington, Indiana nearly a decade ago, where he formed the group Birimbi. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long introduces us to Juan and his Afro-Colombian music, which features the instrument, the marimba.
History of the instrument is very unknown, actually. There is like a myth, you know, the myth in folklore is that marimbo, you know, who was this African slave, you know, that came to Colombia or was brought to Colombia, finally freed himself and managed to go to the forest. And this is in the Pacific coast of Colombia. And while being in the forest, then this person showed up to him, and it was Marimba. So when he met Marimba, then the Marimba came to be. I don't know the exact history. Some people say that this is a xylophone that came from Africa. It's its most plausible origin, you know, since it seems to be very associated with the Afro-Colombian communities. And it's very similar to other xylophones that, you know, occur or that are played in West Africa. But it's different, you know, it's different materials. The way it's tuned is also different than the way the West African xylophones are tuned. So it's a very specific and very endemic instrument from this region, from the Pacific rainforest of Colombia. The traditional music that is played on this instrument is mostly what is called currulao. And this music had remained kind of hidden from the mainstream and from the eye of the urban centers in Colombia forever, until very recently. You know, the first, I guess, research done on the instrument or on the music was by Norman Whitten, you know, an American ethnomusicologist in the 1960s. But that was still very obscure, you know, piece of knowledge that was only known among certain academics and not really in Colombia. So it actually happens with the development of the world music industry and the development of what they now call the new Colombian music industry or scene. And with that, a lot of the musicians from the region started coming to the big cities like Bogota, Medellin, and Cali, you know, to perform their music. And it actually, that developed this whole scene where the instrument became way more visible. A lot of things have happened, you know, since a lot of attempts to make these traditions visible. And that has made the marimba very visible in the Colombian, like, imaginary, in the mass media. The same way the marimba music became now like a UNESCO protected intangible heritage, like work or masterpiece, as they call it. So all of these things have made the tradition way more visible, and that's how I encountered it with some of the older musicians like Gualajo or Baudilio Cuama that were coming to Bogota. So with them I started learning and actually got kind of initiated in the instrument.
You've since imported this tradition and this instrument to Indiana. You were based in Bloomington for many years. Tell me about your decision to form this group and bring this music to Hoosier ears.
For sure. I mean, I was coming in 2010. I was moving to Indiana to spend many years doing grad school in ethnomusicology at IU. So I knew that one of the things I was going to miss the most from home was the music. And what I do is mostly traditional Colombian musics. So I actually did not bring suitcases with me. You know, when I came to Indiana for the first time and to stay for many years, what I brought was a marimba, you know, in a big, gigantic case that looks like a coffin. You know, I've always joked that if I die here, you can bury me in that thing, you know. And the other thing that I brought was an alegre drum, which is the main drum from the Caribbean coast music, you know, to play gaita music, cumbia, bullerengue, and all that stuff. So that's what I brought. And in the space in between the instruments and to fill up the cases, I just put my clothes in. That's all I brought, you know, my clothes and these two instruments. All the years that I was based in Bloomington playing those instruments, they opened me so many doors, and I'm very grateful for the people that taught me, for the people that made the instruments, and for my decision to actually bring them and being able to share some of that with the people here.
Juan, thank you so much for bringing this incredible instrument and tradition to Indiana. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, Kyle. I'm very happy every time I get to play this. I get to show this to people, and I get to have people enjoy it while listening to it. So it's been a pleasure for me, too.
Poem inspire a visual artist like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
This poem called Notes in a Peanut, because I probably have more experience with the physical properties of a peanut than most people in the world, because I have photographed in my artwork, I've photographed many photos where the Peanuts characters are the star of the show. Zombie Peanuts and political peanuts, and then I've done a whole book of peanuts. So I've always loved peanut butter. I have a big affinity for peanut butter and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So I was drawn, as soon as I saw this title, Notes in a Peanut, I was drawn to it. It's funny because June Jordan, she really came to prominence in the 50s and more of the 60s and 70s. She fought for education for minority students especially, but children in general, was very much for the civil rights fight and act. And it's like, this is a parody about George Washington Carver. And I really took some time to kind of research it and read it a couple times. Like, I wanted to see what her motivation was. And no matter what her motivation was, it's a funny poem, an enjoyable poem, but I think one thing she is going for here is, when I was a kid, the one minority famous person of color I learned about in grade school was George Washington Carver. Kind of known as, or presented as kind of an interesting, maybe a kook, because he made all kinds of weird things out of peanut butter, or just peanuts. He made peanut shaving cream, and it's amazing. He's made 300 different kinds of things, I believe, and they're all funny. So she is kind of parodying our thoughts about him and maybe how he was presented in the past. So here it is. Notes on the Peanut by June Jordan. Hi there. My name is George Washington Carver. If you bear with me for a few minutes, I will share with you a few of the 30,117 uses to which the lowly peanut has been put by me since yesterday afternoon. If you will look at my feet, you will notice my sensible shoelaces made from unadulterated peanut leaf composition that is biodegradable to the extreme. To your left, you can observe the lovely Renoir masterpiece reproduction that I have cleverly pieced together from several million peanut shell chips painted painstakingly so as to accurately represent the colors of the original. Overhead, you'll spot a squadron of peanut B-52 bombers flying due west. I would extend my hands to greet you at this time, except for the fact that I am holding a reserve supply of high-energy dry-roasted peanuts, guaranteed to accelerate protein assimilation, precisely documented by my pocket peanut calculator. May I ask, when did you last contemplate the relationship between the expanding peanut product industry and the development of post-Marxian economic theory, which, let me emphasize, does not include moral attrition of pre-puberty polymorphic prehensile skills within the population age sectors of 8 to 15. I hope you will excuse me if I appear to be staring at you through these functional yet high-fashion and prescriptive peanut contact lenses, providing for the most minute observation of your physical response to all of this ultimately nutritional information. peanut butter, peanut soap, peanut margarine, peanut brick houses, and house and field peanut per se so well illustrate the diversified potential of this lowly leguminous plant, to which you may correctly refer also as the goober, the peendar, the ground nut, and the ground pea. Let me interrupt to take your name down on my pocket peanut writing pad, complete with matching peanut pencil that only three or four chewing motions of the jaws will sharpen into a pyrotechnically utility and no sweat. Please, speak right into the peanut. Your name?
He wasn't so kooky. He was just creative.
He was very creative. I mean, he saw a material that no one else was working with, and I think he just took it on as his life's work. Let's see what we can do with this thing.
It completely sums up your work, too, Terry. And if you think back when you were a kid, this was the guy that you knew about but you didn't know about.
Right.
And you run into this again, and you use peanuts in your work.
It's very strange. And I remember a few years ago I was thinking about a story with George Washington Carver would be the evil person, because if peanuts were characters, then obviously they would be very afraid of George Washington Carver. But, yeah, I mean, he's kind of a hero of mine now that I've done some research, and life is funny.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another innovative and probably nutty poem. Still to come on Curious Mix, go with the flow.
You want to come and watch now? Now you won't get splashed so much.
Or maybe not.
The hotter that you can handle, the better.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. We've shared several stories today about artists bringing their work to the people. The same can be said for the Indiana Arts Commission's Arts in the Park projects. That's where artists bring their craft to the people in the great outdoors. Curious Mix's Lee DeNoon takes us to the Tippecanoe River State Park.
There is a bluebird's nest in that box.
In the box
in
here.
In the brown box right here.
Rensselaer photographer Barb Lucas is talking with Cedar Lake resident Rick Burke about camera settings for photographing birds at Tippecanoe River State Park.
I took these at that
That's
box.
That's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, I took those last couple times we've been out here for Art in the Park.
Lucas is president of the Prairie Arts Council and a member of the Jasper County Art League. She jumped at the chance for Art in the Park, spending a weekend in nature, providing opportunities for campers and other visitors to learn from and enjoy various art activities.
We were real excited to be here that first year as they were celebrating the state parks, and now they keep saying, come back, and we keep coming. I think partly it's a joy to see the artists in our group interact with each other, and it strengthens the artist community of our group. So we get to know each other better while we're doing what we love.
Located about 100 miles north of Indianapolis, the river is the main feature of this 75-year-old park. Weekend manager Steve Kottner has lived in the area for a long time, but only came to work at the park 4 years ago. It's been a special place for him.
The Tippecanoe River borders 7 miles of our park. Back when I was a kid, we used to have canoe races on the Tippecanoe River.
There aren't races anymore, but Kottner says a livery at the park rents kayaks and canoes. He says Art in the Park has been getting positive reviews.
I think it's a great thing to do. I've seen some of the projects that come out of here, and I've gotten comments from people in the campground that it's a great thing to have here.
Most of the art activities take place near the Nature Center. Retired educator and longtime Art League member Judy Caney sits at a table under a shade tree with drawing supplies.
Sometimes it's a good idea to do a light sketch like I did here.
Caney encourages 10-year-old Caleb Meeker from Pendleton to indulge.
Did you want to try a tree, or do you want to try a flower, or
what if you want to draw doesn't exist? Like, what if you want to draw hydra?
You can make up something out of your head.
And that's exactly what Caleb decided to do.
Well, it's a cat with its torso is basically just a Pop-Tart. And it's basically a YouTube video.
Does that one have a name?
Its name's Nine Cat. Yeah, Nine Cat.
Inside the Nature Center, painter and artist Lynn Buckmaster of DeMott helps kids paint rocks to look like animals.
You're doing awesome. You're doing great. And that's all you're going to need for the ears. You got that done already. Good job.
A few steps outside the Nature Center, retired art teacher Gail Wolliver is at a potter's wheel.
You want to come and watch now? Now you won't get splashed so much. Okay. I am going to bring my fingers towards my hand.
It's getting bigger.
Didn't it? Isn't that awesome?
Wolliver says she feels a deep connection to nature and loves sharing art in the park with families.
We try to base most everything that we do on nature and how we can interact with nature and appreciate nature more. Last year we had a lady who did gourds, decorated gourds, made birdhouses. This year she did recycling of materials to use for bird feeders as well as birdhouses and wind chimes, things that are fun to decorate nature with.
Do you like working with clay?
Yeah, I'm going to be a potter when I grow up.
I hope so.
Wolliver and Jasper County Art League plan to be back at the park in 2019. For Curious Mix, I'm Lee DeNoon.
It's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know where to find the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. If you need a tamale, savor your sweet, try the Tamale Place.
My name is Micah Harshaw. This is the Tamale Place. I'm the manager here. We've got three locations, one on the south side in Greenwood and one on the west side on Rockville and Lyndhurst, about 5 minutes from IMS, and then, of course, this one inside of City Market. What's inside the tamales? It's first wrapped in a corn husk, and then we spread the masa, which is basically, just in layman's terms, corn dough, just spread on the inside of that. And then your meats and sauce. We have our vegetarian tamales, a veggie and green sauce that just an assortment of really hearty and rich vegetables. And we also have like a poblano and a black bean and cheese. And then we also have dessert tamales as well, where it's got one of our dessert tamales, it's got apple pie filling. And then we got the pumpkin. They come to us frozen from the main store. Sometimes they come fresh. We place them in a freezer if we're not using them for the day. And then when we do use them, we take them out of the package that we get them sent in. We place them inside of the tamale pot. We light the pot, 50 minutes to boil, and then they're all ready to go. My favorite way to enjoy it is right out of the tamale pot. If I take one home, I wrap it in a damp paper towel and put it in the microwave for maybe a minute so it's kind of steamed again and really hot. The hotter that you can handle, the better, because it tastes more fresh right out of the pot.
They've got three locations in Greenwood, Speedway, and the City Market downtown. Once upon a time, there was a young boy who dreamed of being on the stage, but his teacher told him he wasn't good enough. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez introduces us to designer Beck Jones, who is creating his own happy ending.
I remember the most like heartbreaking talk I've ever had with Justin Wade, or at least at the time it was. I was sitting in his office and he was like, "You are not an actor." And I was like, you know, my little eighth grade heart was like, "Justin!" I was like, "Oh no." He was like, "You are not an actor, you are a costume designer."
Not everyone gets a frank, honest discussion so early in their career. But for Beck Jones, it was game changing.
And he wanted to bring me on at the start of my freshman year as the head costumer for Yonkers Theater.
Challenge accepted. But it was hard to let go of early dreams, especially when they're so central to Jones's origin story.
I started in third grade, actually, as an actor at Yonkers Theater, which is down at the Athenaeum. And then, you know, I acted there and I was like, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be on Broadway. You know, that's what I was going to be. I was like, this is what I'm made to do. And then I kind of like got into the weird world of making some props for them for some shows. And then finally in seventh grade, I was like, I want to make a costume. And so like, we were doing The Little Mermaid and I was like, I really want to make a mermaid. I was like, let's do it. And so I was like, Justin Wade, who's the executive director, I was like, can I costume the show? And they were like, this little seventh grade boy is wanting to costume our show. And I'm like, yes, I am.
The whole show.
The whole show. So it was like all like 25 kids, you know, I'm like, I can do it. I did it.
Did you know how to sew before you
did? No, I did not. I actually originally started with just like hand sewing and a hot glue gun, which now I'd be like...
Jones hates backing down from a challenging task. He charged into eighth grade with the same zeal and proved that The Little Mermaid wasn't just a fluke.
They kind of realized, they were like, hey, you know, this kid's got something.
But Jones still didn't know how to sew. It's kind of an important skill for a costume designer. Enter Connie Alonzo.
Connie Alonzo, who's like the first mentor I ever had. Sadly, she passed away from cancer a few years ago. But she was the lady who taught me to sew. She did everything. She actually taught me to sew right before she passed away. So like, it was a huge thing. She was the biggest mentor I've probably ever had, and I'll remember her and thank her for everything.
Alonzo's lessons certainly stuck. Now, if Jones is using a hot glue gun, it's only out of necessity for unconventional materials.
One of the first big things that I pointed out for was my newspaper wigs. Roald Dahl's The Witches, like, all the witches wear wigs. And so instead of buying, you know, all these, like, crappy wigs, like Shake and Go, we were like, let's, like, make them something. And so we made them out of newspaper.
I brush my teeth before I eat breakfast.
I do, too.
I would never brush my teeth before I ate breakfast.
Adding unexpected twists is a feature, not a bug, for Jones. He's exercised that well through 7th Artistry.
When it was the last day of school, it couldn't have been that bad.
A theater company he founded with Fiona Dwyer. Their latest work, The Little Red Riding Hood, showcased a cast of 7 in stark white costumes with a similarly ghostly set, using a portion of the Circle City Industrial Complex.
During the piece, we'll be moving around to different locations in the room. You ever feel lost?
We take a classic fairy tale and completely change it. I think one of our best examples was when we did Sleeping Beauty for the Fringe Fest. We set it in during the witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts. The fairies, we called them the evils. They were like, speak no evil, hear no evil, do no evil. They were like these gauze creations that I made, and I love them to this day. They're some of my favorite dresses. We did Hansel and Gretel set in the 1920s. We have Princess and the Pea in the French Revolution. We had Beauty and the Beast set in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
While juggling his responsibilities at Heron High School, Jones also designed for photo shoots with Pattern Magazine. This led to opportunities to design for the Snake Pit Ball.
One of my favorite things to do when I do a piece is like the research behind it. I think it's so interesting. And so I was like researching the race, and I was like, what could we do? And so we made a corset out of bike tires, and like the whole dress was made of photos from the Indianapolis 500.
This year was a futuristic feel. One dress had a clear acrylic globe as a space helmet, and several dresses were lit with sewn-in LED strings. All of this on the heels of designing for Blair St. Clair of RuPaul's Drag Race at the RuPaul Drag Con in Los Angeles.
I worked with Blair for her audition, and I helped her with the show, and so she asked me to come on and design some stuff for her for RuPaul's Drag Con. I designed 3 dresses, so it was one each day, and we kind of told a story of, like, this girl fresh off the bus to working in a big city to being on a Broadway stage.
He relishes defying expectations, including with his age.
I like doing something weird, like making you think, being like, what the heck is he doing? And especially at such a young age, it's something that's been so nice to be like, what is this 18, 17-year-old kid doing with his life? He's like over here dressing a drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race. And it's like, So that's like my favorite thing. It's just the reaction.
While his high school years have come to a close, his career is only beginning.
I turn 19 and then the next day I leave for college.
And you're going to?
Parsons School of Design in New York City.
And now Beck Jones has time to reflect on that devastating early conversation.
At the time, I was like, this is the most heartbreaking thing in the world. But now I'm like, that was the best conversation I've ever had. If I had never had that conversation, I would never be sitting here. I would never have worked with Blair St. Clair. I would never have done Snake Bit. I would have never been in Pattern Magazine. I would have never done all these things that talk gave me.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Curious Mix is made possible in part by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Matt Pelser,
Joy Hernandez,
Carter Barrett,
Lee DeNoon,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.